Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And once again, I'm very happy to tell you that I am broadcasting from Milan, Italy at the Expo Milano 2015. And we are getting some of the most extraordinary chefs through here. We are wowing Italy and Europe. And today and tonight at J Bar, I think we're going to have one of the best and brightest meals that we've had. And Ming Zai is here. And we're just going to get right into it, Ming. Welcome to Italy.
Nice to be here.
When did you get here?
You know, my wife and I have been here over a week. We did 3 days in Roma, which was awesome. We kind of liken Rome to like Atlanta, being southern, the southern hospitality kind of idea. I mean, the food obviously is not the same, but delicious food. Great pizza.
Where'd you eat?
We had a really nice meal at Rosciole. Beautiful. We had the cacio e pepe was like the most perfect ever. They have a great pizza joint just across around the corner with crispy pizzas, the way I like it, thin crust, and you pick your own. But then we went to a place called Pizzarium after seeing, not only seeing the Vatican, the Sistine Chapel, hearing the Pope speak. Our luck was just like he was there on the yeah, he was at St. Peter's Square speaking. We're like, oh my God, there's the Pope, which is just amazing. It's just, I am not Catholic, but it is. To be there with 6,000 to 8,000 people, surrounded by nuns and priests, is just a great, great feeling. And we had a really nice seafood meal at Asante du Madre. They're known for their beautiful, just fresh whole fish and raw shrimp and raw crayfish. Delicious, really good. I mean, just.
How did you research it? I mean, really,
you know, I asked all my chef friends, right? I asked Mario Batali, I asked Barbara Lynch. Happened to be in L.A. shooting Simply Ming right before, and just coincidentally, Suzanne Goyen just finished Alex's Lemonade that same night. So Mark Vitri was there and his whole crew. So we had dinner together, and Mark's like, you got to go here and there. We then ended up at another great place called Beer and Food. Beer and Food, spelled B-I-R, then and F-U-D, so kind of German. but you know what? They had they had 36 microbrews on tap, which you don't think there is in Italy. And around the corner from them was another pizza place, Dar Poeta, equally delicious. And they let so that was delicious. And then Beer and Food also has Bonci, which is the same chef that does Pizzarium. So we had a lot of pizza, a lot of pasta. And then we shot up because the trains are so great here. We went all the way through Milan to Lake Como, which has just always been a dream of ours to go there.
Your first time up there?
Yeah, first time. It was actually our 20th anniversary, so we're celebrating.
So where did you stay up there?
We stayed at Tremezza, the Grand Hotel Tremezza. It looked like Hotel Budapest. It was just out of the movies. We really thought Cary Grant was going to just, you know, walk by. It was just perfect. And it was perfect weather. They have the pool that's floating in the lake. It was unbelievable, and the restaurant was excellent. The service was just top notch, and it was one of those pinch me moments that we're really looking at this view into the mountains and just fantastic food. Probably the Paul Bocuse of Italy, Marchese, is the consulting chef at this hotel. So he had his famous saffron risotto, right? Risotto Milanese with the gold leaf.
Right.
Beautiful, these gigantic macaroni they call it with lobster. It was, again, another tremendous meal. So we've been doing really well. Then we've only been here in Milan. This is our second night.
Did you eat last night?
We went to Antica Trattoria,
yes.
Del Rosa, I think.
Yeah.
Really classic. No seafood, only meat, only red wine.
Did you have the veal cotoletta?
Si. We had the veal. One of my chefs had the tripe. Another chef had the beef tartare. I also had something, the the jumping risotto, right? The risotto al salto.
Oh, I haven't had that.
It's a crispy risotto, which was, you know, delicious as well. And the risotto that's made here, it is so perfectly al dente. Each grain of rice is separate, and they serve such a thin layer. It's something it's totally a skill.
So now this is supposed to be all about Ming, not all about Milan, but this is the latest. This is the last. It's last 5 days of Ming. But so the first thing I want to do is really ask you about where did you grow up? What were you eating? What was Ming like at 5 years old?
Hungry. Still am. You know, I was born in Newport Beach, California, but barely spent time there. We ended up in Dayton, Ohio. So I'm 18 years. I'm a Midwest boy. My dad was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, chief scientist. He's still at 86.
What kind of science?
He's the leading graphite designer in the world. So the plane I just flew in, the Airbus A380, all his theories on using graphite material, composite materials, was something he's been preaching for 70 years. So everything from space shuttle to B-1 bombers, which is why he was in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base at the time.
Was he just a military employee, or was he in the military?
He was actually civilian at the Air Force, chief scientist, high up in the government. And he would go and at the time just really travel the world and see what everyone else is doing with composite materials, including China and Russia. This is during the Cold War. He went into China.
He would go there
with the government knowledge to see their labs, to see what they were really doing. But of course, they only saw Lab A. They never saw the real labs. And just like when the Russians came here, we didn't show them the real labs. But he would always debrief by the CIA in D.C. when he came back. But everything, you know, down to a golf shaft is composite materials. So I grew up in that type of environment, thinking, being a Chinese son, that I'm going to be a doctor, lawyer, engineer. And of course, I picked engineering because that's who my dad was. But I at 5 and 6 and 7, I literally was always in the kitchen. My parents were both great cooks. My mom's really the technical cook. She'll cook the perfect.
Your parents were born in the States?
My parents were born in Beijing. I'm first generation.
You're first generation. Yeah. And, ABC, right?
Yeah, ABC. and I have a side, something I'm very proud of. It's an incredible story. There's a great professor, Henry Louis Gates at Harvard, which he did on me last year, which went back 36 generations. And my kids are generation 36. So he was already ahead of the game. He was already as deep as almost anyone else, period. So that went back to like 800 AD. And so he got to start with that. But the story is unbelievable. So he takes this book, gets a Chinese researcher that goes to China for 2 weeks, who just miraculously ends up in the Shanghai Hunan area where my grandparents were from. And through folklore, they used to have these things called steles, which are these carved stone historical records, because there was no paper then. So they would carve, and families would carve into the stone their history so they would keep record of it. And through really hearsay, this researcher says, you got to go where these two rivers meet. There's one stele left. She goes there. It's a stele on my family. The only one on my family. This stele not only confirms our book, which we already knew was legit because it's been passed down, and I'm actually in charge of being the youngest of my generation. It proved that it was legit.
What do you mean you're in charge? You have the book physically?
It's copies of the book, right? Yeah. So I'm in charge of recording my kids and my nephews and nieces.
Oh.
And actually Henry, my youngest son, is the youngest of the next generation. So this book that we already have has the first name. So I'm the Ming generation, predestined from 34 generations ago. So my brother's name is Ming Shi. I'm Ming Hao, Ming Hui, Ming Jie, Ming Yao. Those are all our cousins. Everyone calls me, of course, Ming Sai. Everyone calls my brother Ming Sai. It's a little confusing in the business world, but we get along, and it works. So my kids are Jia. Jia means family or foundation. So my first son is Jia Long, which is foundation or house of the dragon. He was born 2000, which is year of the dragon, which my wife and I are both dragons. And then Henry is Jia Ming, you know, I guess after me. But their kids are already named all the way down, right? This goes for 60 generations. So it's already, after the 60th generation, which is another 26, then either...
Wait. We were at 37 generation.
We're at 36. My kids are the 37th.
Where does 60 come in?
Well, this book has the names already predestined to the 60th.
Oh, so...
So my kids' kids already have their first part of their name, and their kids and kids all the
Oh, so your Ming is predestined. Your last name, Cy. Everybody. Cy is everybody. So. But Ming was predestined how long
34
ago?
34 generations ago. So I'm generation 35. My kids are generation 36. And it goes to 60. But that's not the amazing part. The most amazing part is then this researcher with the stealing information ended up in Shanghai at the Rare Books Library, the National Library, and under glass was the same book, the same cover, same Chinese characters, Tsai family generation, that whole thing, but it was bigger and it was red, and it was the original, it was thicker. This book goes back to 2500 BC.
No.
My great-great-grandfather, 100 generations ago, was Huang Di, one of the original Chinese emperors.
Wow.
It's like, are you kidding me? And it's documented. It's documented. And but if you think about it, if you can grasp that concept, first of all, that had to be male-born every generation, yes. Otherwise it wouldn't continue.
Right.
Huang Di invented Chinese. Huang Di invented governmental system. Chinese the language. He invented Chinese. This is 2500
so
BC.
So there have been dialects all spoken, and he standardized it?
I haven't spoken.
Made a right. But he made the written language.
They didn't have paper yet, right?
So.
And by the way, Cai Lun, which is about 63 generations ago, invented paper. Who's also in...
In your
Yeah,
family.
So if he patented that process, I would really? Own
right.
the world.
Hey, Rome.
Can you imagine?
You'd own Rome. I mean, those Johnny-come-latelys.
Piece of paper. but it's just, you know, when I was so... So we had this family tree that they gave that William... That we call him Skip. It's taller than the ceiling. And it starts with Huang Di and goes all the way...
So how many people are Zais?
Are Zais? That's a great... You know what? That's a great question. Thousands. It would have to be.
So anyone with the name Tsai?
Well, no, because if you're Smith, you're not necessary. You know, if your last name is Washington, are
you
George Washington?
It's your
but we know
son.
It's a direct lineage in this book, the Rare Books, that's basically documented.
So what kind of pressure does that put on you? You know, being the...
The 100-generation Tsai?
Emperor.
You know, well, I'll tell you the funny story. So we go home after this whole thing happens, and I open this to my two kids and wife and say, look, guys... First, you can't say this because the show hasn't aired yet. But let me just show you something. And this is something we need to be proud of and be proud to be Chinese and be proud to be a Tsai. But we actually go back. You guys are the 101st generation Tsai. And Henry, who is my now 13, he was 12 at the time, he jumps up and down and we all hug and scream because it's a big news.
Yeah.
And so, dad, what's this mean? You know, he's thinking, is there a gold chair going to come up our driveway with riches?
Do you have a palace back in the old country?
Do we own the Great Wall? I'm like, Henry, it means trash is still Tuesdays, and you still have to feed Buddy every morning, and you got to do your homework and brush your teeth and floss. It means, you can be even prouder to be a Tsai.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't feel more pressure. I mean, I've always been proud to be Chinese. I speak Chinese. Both my kids are taking Chinese in school. And I very biasedly still think Chinese is the best food in the world. And that's always been the glue of our whole family.
Yes.
Just growing up in Dayton, Ohio, for your original question, while eating dinner, we'd always be talking about where we're eating next or what are we eating next, period. It's just food. And my dad would, for example, again, being this engineer, he would hold these graphite conferences in France. Thierry Massard is one of his partners in Think Composites, his company. And I'm actually the godfather of their first son, Sebastian, so really close family friends. He would first call Taiwan. This is back in the day. It was really hard to get into three-star restaurants. Get the reservation, then determine that the conference needs to be this weekend. So that's how much food meant.
So you grew up mainly in Dayton, Ohio?
I grew up 18 years in Dayton, but then I did go to Andover for prep school because my grandfather went to Yale, 1918.
Right.
He was discovered by Christian missionaries. The program was called Yale in China. And because my grandfather's grandfather was high up in the government in the province, governor of a province, so had better access.
So was your family from that province or from?
Yeah, from Hunan.
This
is about Hunan, yeah. So my dad's dad was from Hunan. So he came to Yale, went back to China, Then, of course, a man named Mao Zedong came through, the Cultural Revolution. He fled to Taipei, to Taiwan. My dad, one of four brothers, all ended up, well, three ended up at Yale. They all fled to the States. They fortunately all got out. And funny enough, tomorrow night at this dinner in Milan is Shirley Young. Her grandfather flew my grandfather out during the Cultural Revolution.
Wow.
He was the pilot that flew him out.
Wow.
And she's coming to this dinner tomorrow night.
Is she an American or
she's Chinese?
She's Chinese.
Yeah, but she lives in America.
She lives in Italy, not just for
my dinner. She happened to be here, and my dad just reconnected with her in L.A. literally last month. I've never met her. She must be, you know, my dad's 86, so I'm sure the same age, and so that's just very cool.
That is very cool. Right. So what were you like at 12? What were you into at 12?
I love sport. I played a lot of tennis.
Tennis?
Yeah, tennis was my first sport. I played all the way through Andover, but then picked up squash, and the squash became my real sport. I played at Yale and played a couple years pro in France, which was a great hobby and made some money on the weekends when I was cooking when I was living in Paris. But I was always in the kitchen. I mean, I say this all the time. I was, still am, and will always be hungry. So as a kid, I realized if I hung out in the kitchen, grandparents or parents would throw you scraps. But I loved just watching them. I learned to sharpen cleavers at a very young age because my grandfather, who was just my hero, he would grow. By that time, he was retired, lived in Dayton, Ohio, in an apartment close by. He grew cucumbers and his own chili peppers. He'd make his own sambal, you know, lajiao. He'd make his own dumpling wrappers and noodles. And every Friday night in Dayton, Ohio, 5 p.m., we'd go for dinner at Yaya Nainai's grandparents. It was my favorite day of the week. And I got to spend a lot of time with them, and I wish I spent twice as much time, three times more time, because, you know, once they're gone, they're gone. And I'm blessed. And I tell my kids, look, you got living grandparents. My parents are still alive, and one of my mother-in-law is still alive. Just take advantage of that, because so many children didn't know their grandparents at all. And both my parents still like to cook. And it's always what brought us back. And even when I was in Taipei, I lived there 3 months once when I was 13 to learn Chinese. Went to a school called Goyi Zhibao. And to hang out with my grandfather, walking down a place called Ximending in Taipei, where people would grab you to come in for the pot stickers and the scallion pan. Tsun yo bing, la 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 la. They literally grab you and seat you before you could say no. A dozen pot stickers are in front of you. And it cost like a dollar. I mean, you lived like kings back then, right? I mean, it was so great to be American back then. And I remember these. And I remember specifically this baozi called gobuli baozi. Gobuli baozi literally translates, this is so bad not even a dog would eat it, right? So not a great marketing name, but they were the juiciest, super crispy, pan-seared on one side, but a baozi, not a pot sticker. And you always get juice all over you. And again, it'd be like a dollar for a dozen. And I remember you sit on these plastic seats and everything's no sanitary dishes. You see them go in and out of a pail.
Okay, was the food, right? Your grandparents were great cooks and your parents in Dayton, Ohio. And when you went to Taipei, was it a new revelation because of the product or was it very similar?
Well, you know, I mean, I grew up going to Taipei. I mean, I literally went to Taipei almost every other summer. This is before my grandparents came to the States. So they lived there. So between ages 1 and 13 or 10 and 1 and 12, every other summer I go to Taipei. So it really is part of – I always ate Chinese street food.
So, but how good was the approximation that your parents could do here in Ohio?
It's you could actually do better Chinese food here because – the quality of the pork, the quality of the produce is better. And, you know, to make the dough is the same. It's all-purpose flour. So, honestly, you can make scallion pancakes and dumplings and everything almost even better because it's better products.
I see. So you were at Andover, and then you went to Yale. And what did you study, and how did you then get to France? And tell us all that part of
it. Yeah, you know, I mean, I studied mechanical engineering at Yale because that's just what I wanted to be. I wanted to be like dad. And I actually had three rules growing up in my family. I have one brother who's two and a half years older, who's also studied engineering, also went to Andorio. And our rules were you can get any grades you want as long as they're straight A's. You could be anything you want as long as it's a doctor, lawyer, engineer. And marry anyone you want. We prefer Chinese. I'm 0 for 3. Not even close. However, my fantastic wife of 20 years, Polly, who is Caucasian, waspier than any wasp you'd ever meet from Dayton, Ohio, born in Dayton, Ohio. We never met, right? Literally a mile away from where I grew up. I grew up in Kettering. She grew up in Oakwood, across a big street called Dorothy Lane. We never met there, but her brother was my squash coach at Yale. And she, of all things, went to CU Boulder and studied Chinese, just blindly.
Wow.
Because she just didn't want to study anything else. And she visited my sophomore year at Yale. So in 1983, I met her. And her David, my brother, who we named our first son after, said, look, there's this Chinese guy on my team who's pretty cool. He speaks Chinese. You might want to meet. We met. She really wanted nothing to do with me. And I kind of hounded her, followed her, traced her, tracked her, we'll call it what you want, for 10 years. And finally, after 10 years, and I'm best friends with David, who's the squash coach. We finally ended up in San Francisco together. And she came to the restaurant where I was sous chef at Silks at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel. And I guess the combination of being in a really good restaurant, eating a great meal, maybe some wine, and seeing me in a chef coat swayed her, like, oh, I could eat well with this guy. So,
charm factor, you're leaving out of that. So, you study mechanics
at Yale. Every summer, I started going to Paris because, again, we had the French friends, the Mossart, Thierry and Pascal. So, I had a free place to stay in Paris, which was a great, you know, I'm very grateful for that. And so, the first year I went to Alliance Française to master French. I had Andover French, which was okay, but you live in France with a French family and then do stagiaires at a French restaurant, you speak French or you drown, you're done. So I went to start doing stages. Then I went back after sophomore summer.
So when did you really start wanting to cook professionally?
So by junior year, I'm in France. This time I go to Cordon Bleu for the summer. 3-month program, advanced.
The one in Paris.
The one in Paris. The original, Champ de Mars, the original. Only taught in French. And I did advanced cuisine because I had enough skills, knife skills and, you know, wok stirring skills, but the same translate to saute skills. Right. And I did beginning pastries. And that was amazing because pastries, we don't have anything like that in Chinese cuisine. It's just a revelation. You make your first crème pâtissière, your crème anglaise, I mean, pâte feuilletée. You're like, oh, my God, this stuff's amazing. And that's when I said, you know what? I want to be a chef. Not only do I want to be a chef, I want to blend French techniques with Chinese techniques because I think both are in my humble opinion, I know we're in Italy, but the Chinese and French are the two best cuisines in the world. And Italy and Japan are such a close second. I mean, we're really picking straws. And I know Jose Andres says, hey, Spain. I mean,
what am I, chop liver?
Yeah, exactly. No, you're pate, dude. But again, I'm totally biased. Right. But I called it Frenese cuisine, French Chinese. And so before I graduated, I told my parents, you know, and they knew. They knew I had a knack. They knew I had a love, a passion for food. And
there, you blame them. They were taken.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And my mom, if you've ever seen her on my show, she is so brilliant and gregarious. She's like, oh, son, that's awesome. You're so lucky at such a young age. You actually know what you want to do and you follow your passion, your dream. Go cook. You know, just promise you give 110%. We love you. Go for it. And I looked at my dad, same conversation, who's much more pensive. You know, he's literally a genius. I mean, he's one of the only geniuses I personally have known. He looked up to me and goes, son, you weren't going to be a very good engineer anyway. Go cook. I'm like, wow. Tell me what you really think, Dad. And but he's right. If you don't love something, you're not going to be good at it.
Love what you do. That's
love what you do. So then literally 2 days after graduating from Yale, I'm on a plane to Paris. And that's where I got to so luckily get to work for Pierre Hermé at Fouchon. In the 22 pastry cook downstairs kitchen. And that's what I saw.
How did you get in there?
It was, again, my French friends, Thierry, they knew someone who knew someone, and I spoke enough French, which is their first question, you know, can you communicate? And, you know, and just you know, please, s'il vous plaît, you know.
How many hours did you work?
Oh, I worked a week. I had the charmed life because I would work 5 days a week. I would get there at 5 or sometimes 6 a.m. So I'd work a full shift. It wasn't crazy. I'd work like an 8 or 9 hour shift because 3 weeks into that, and I wasn't getting paid. I was a stagiaire at Fouchon, right? I eventually became a page cook. In the beginning, I didn't get paid. Eating in the cafeteria, which is an awesome cafeteria because it's all the 1- and 2-day-old traiteur cuisine, which are, you know, stuffed ducks with foie gras and, you know, salmon on the Koulibiac salmon with, you know, brioche dough. I mean, it was not, it was amazing food. It was Fouchon food, right? But they would always get calls and they would literally, someone would call looking for an extra. They needed a cook. So they would literally, the phone would ring and someone would like, hey, can I have ce soir? You know, and like, what was it? You know, my French wasn't awesome, but I asked one of my cook friends, they're like, they're looking for an extra. I'm like, what's that? Well, it's working at this, I don't know what restaurant, but to go worker service and they'll pay you en noir, right? Gagné en noir under the table, yeah. Like 200 or 300 francs, which was real money, right? Because right. I wasn't getting anything. Right. And so I'm like, oh, oui. Yeah. And so I went to Natasha that night. And Natasha's is Russian, the patron is Russian French, named Natasha. She had this cool little, it was a restaurant branché, as they said, which is a la mode. So no tourists, but all the French artists and authors, and like when Simply Red was in or Prince, they would eat there. So it was a really small 60 seat restaurant. And Jean-Marc was this great chef there, really young. I mean, I'm 21 or 20, and he's only 26. And we got along like that. He really wanted to learn about Chinese. And I really want to learn about French. And literally the next day, so I worked there. He liked me. He says, yeah, demain. And so now he's doing doubles. So I worked at Fouchon in the mornings. I get off at 3, and I get to Natasha by 5, and then I work till 2. And I do that for 5 days a week. And then I would get on a train and then go to play a pro squash tournament Saturday, Sunday.
No.
And I repeat. But it was awesome because the pro squash tournaments got me all over France. Bordeaux, Aix-en-Provence, Toulouse, Marseille.
But you didn't have any time to practice during the week. I mean, but you had plenty of physical.
Yeah, I did. You know what? But those 2 hours in between, I played. I ran. I would run 600s and stuff and play. Yeah, absolutely. It was the best life ever.
If anyone ever dreamt that they want to be like Ming Zai, no way. I mean, that's superhuman. When did you sleep? How much do you sleep?
I still don't sleep. I sleep 5 or 6. I don't need sleep.
You don't need sleep. Who needs sleep?
You catch up and sleep the first day you're dead.
That's true.
I mean, like, you know, I have my crew here. We're like, you guys want, you know, you tired? You want to go? What do you mean? We just got to Milan. Of course we're going now. I mean, you're here. You're
Wimps.
Not going to sleep.
Wimps. Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Dave Arnold from Cooking Issues, and I'm here to talk to you about the Museum of Food and Drink, which is finally getting a brick-and-mortar space right here in Brooklyn, New York. So the Museum of Food and Drink is opening the MOFAD Lab, our first laboratory and gallery space, where we will be putting on an exhibition called Making It or Faking It, the history of the flavor industry. And it tackles a very important topic, which is how the food system got to be the way it is now as a result of the intervention of the flavor industry, how that happened. Get your tickets at tickets.mofad.org to come see the first exhibit ever of the Museum of Food and Drink at the MOFAD Lab, brought to you by Infinity on 62 Bayard Street.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story. And today our guest is Ming Zai, but we're sitting in Milan. And we've just finished your tour of duty maybe in France. Why did you leave France? And when you came back, what was your journey?
So I left France. I so didn't want to leave France. I had this great life, a fantastic British girlfriend, Nikki. I just was so torn.
Did you enjoy the pro circuit?
Oh, it was so fun being a pro athlete. And we made nothing, right? I mean, I could play. If I got to the semis or finals, I'd make like, you know, 3,000 francs or 4,000. So it'd be like 1,000. It was enough money to pay for the train ride, the hotel, and the bar bill. And then maybe I have a few $100 left over. But it was a great way to meet people and see the country. Because when you go and play squash tournaments, the locals take you out. So you never, ever go to a touristy place. You go to the place. Now, can I tell you a great story? So we were in Rouen. And I'm with my two expat friends. So there's, you know, the Kiwis, the Aussies, the Brits, the Swedes, they're all really good in squash. And we'd always end up meeting in the semis. The good news is the French were horrible at squash. That's the only reason I was in the top 10, right? Now they're good. But back then, because I was not even close to being top 100 pro in this country, to be honest. But in France that time, they were horrible, thank God. So they took us to this one bistro. And we all sat down, a long table, like 20 of us, and all the French folks were like smirking, like they all swallowed a cat or a rat or something. Like, what's going on? We all looked at my friends, we don't know. And this well-dressed tuxedo guy, black apron, goes, oh, bonsoir, blah, 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 says this is the special and everything and all this stuff. And we take the order, and he walks away, he is butt naked. We look around, every waiter is butt naked. And that was the shtick of this restaurant. These two gay guys own the restaurant, and their whole shtick was they served everyone naked. And we could not stop laughing about it. So you don't get that experience.
In Rouen.
Yeah,
in Paris.
You don't get experience.
Marseille.
Like, that's crazy. Yeah. We're like, oh, that's funny. God. So the reason I left Paris is I ended up going to Cornell, to the hotel school. So I ended up getting a master's.
So, okay. So was that your idea? Did you your parents?
That was both. I knew I wanted to be a chef owner one day.
Right.
I knew I needed to learn everything else besides cooking in the business.
Yes.
And there were two schools. I actually got accepted to Lausanne. So I graduated in 1986. I got accepted to Lausanne like class of 1994. I'm like, I got deferred. I'm like, just say no, guys. I mean, and Lausanne would not have been as good for me. It would have been great and took the cooking part.
Yeah.
But Cornell really had more of what I needed, which is the marketing, the accounting, reading a P&L, just the design of hotels, restaurants, all that.
Right.
So it was a great master's program. The best, of course, is you get to meet the people. You get to meet some of the best professors. You get to meet some of the, you know, you get to meet the top in the industry. And so that really set me then up for, okay. And I was not a great chef. I was a solid cook. On my resume, honestly, I said I was a sous chef, Natasha. There's three of us in the kitchen. There's a dishwasher, garde-manger. There's a chef and me. So I was a cook, but I was a sous chef. I was number two. Anyway, once you graduate Cornell, I said, well, I might as well work in the hotel business and let's apply this. So I ended up opening the Hotel Intercontinental in Chicago as the assistant F&B and then became F&B director. And that was just a great experience. But after 2 years, I hated it. I hated not cooking. I wanted to just be breaking down fish and sauteing and cooking. I had this creativeness I had to get out. And I actually hated the hotel business because it was all about kissing up to the general manager. And we had a particular Austrian, maniacal, narcissistic general manager, which I think all Austrian general managers are in every hotel country, in every hotel in the world.
Just over the mountains
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I know. Sándor Stangl, right? Even the name sounds narcissistic. Anyway, and it's, you know, like I get the call at 5 in the morning and the room service order is like, where are you? I'm like, sleeping? Right? I mean, where are you? At the hotel and the, you know, vice president. And it's like, you know, so after that, I'm like, you know, this is for the birds. I need to go back cooking. And that's how I ended up as sous chef. I got a job a little over my head, I have to admit, as a cook, because I was a really good cook. I wasn't quite sous chef, but because I had, you know, hold the Excel spreadsheet stuff and the knowledge of P&Ls and a fast learner, I became sous chef at Silks in the Mandarin. And that started my chef career. And so I never not cooked since then. So after the Mandarin, I then opened a restaurant in Palo Alto called Ginger Club. That was a brief 6-month thing. And then going to Santa Cafe in Santa Fe, which was the best restaurant in Santa Fe. And that was my first executive chef job and loved it. And I brought the first James Beard dinner to New Mexico, where I had Juniper and ZMC, Dom Pintambono from Tribeca Grill, Ken Oranger from Silks, who we worked together with, Gary Robbins from Asia, which used to be a great east-west restaurant in New York City. I don't know where Gary is these days. Michael Guignard brought all the foie gras, and Sousa Lee, who I got to meet for the first time, who is really one of my best friends now with Ken Oranger. Sousa and Pinto I just saw recently in Tampa. Sousa is really one of the best east-west chefs in the world. I mean, he's amazing and so skilled. And so that was a great meal. And so then Santa Cafe, about 2 years. And then from there, I realized I needed to be my own. I needed to be a chef owner. So we started looking everywhere. I actually first went to Paris and London to see if I wanted to open there. Fortunately, nothing really panned out. And then we started really thinking about it. We're like, do we really want to be so far away? We wanted to have children from grandparents and stuff. And the answer was no. So we wanted to be stateside. I had a great offer. I'll tell you the quick story because I think we have guests showing up.
Don't worry, they're drinking.
Okay, good. So are we. So are we.
Don't tell them. Okay. We are. We got some nice red wine here.
We're in Milan. When in Rome. We're in Milan. So I had a great service. We did like 350 dinners. The Santa Cafe was busy as hell in the summer. And this guy comes to the bar with glasses. He's like, hey, chef had a great meal. Love to talk about opening a restaurant in Vegas. Now, I have to preface this with 2 weeks before this, my wife had the conversations like, we need to get out of Dodge. This is just for the birds. We just can't raise family here. And there's lots of reasons, but there's really the animosity between the Native Americans and the Mexicans and then all the rich Caucasians. It just didn't mix, right? It's just for the obvious reasons. And we didn't want to be in the desert. So she said, okay, I'll go anywhere in the world you want. We just can't move from a bleeping desert to a bleeping desert, which basically means no Vegas. So this guy still says, I want to do something in Vegas. But, you know, my dad trains. Just listen to every opportunity. You don't know. So he says, look, we're doing this great new project. It's going to be just monstrosity. You can spend up to $5 million building out your own restaurant with no risk. We're going to give you 10% on revenue. Giving you 5%. So I was making $75,000 a time. I was going to make $500,000 plus if the restaurant was only okay. I mean, it was just ridiculous. I never heard of these numbers. And I'm like, sir, that's just a ridiculous offer. But for personal reasons, I unfortunately have to decline. He goes, well, that's okay. My name is Steve Wynn. I'm opening up the Bellagio. If you change your mind, let me know. And Todd English got that spot, which is really the best spot with the fountain at the Bellagio, where Olives is, and the rest.
Now we know what Todd got paid.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's his best. It's his most profitable restaurant in his whole portfolio, for sure. But no regrets because of all that, and we decided we needed a place with a Chinatown for quality of life, for getting my products I need for my cuisine cheaply, because in Santa Fe, bok choy is like $8 a pound. I'm like, bok choy is 80 cents a pound, so that was stupid. And we settled on Boston, and that's how Blue Ginger started.
So a San Francisco that has a very large population, or a New York City?
We looked at both. We could not afford to buy a home in San Francisco, right? Dot-coms are crazy. We didn't want to live in Berkeley or beyond to work in San Francisco. And my food is already popular, my style of food. So build where there's no competition.
Did you know people in
Berkeley? Berger is the one who, and Todd English. Yeah. I knew both of them. Like, dude, come to Boston. And I give Todd great credit because Todd was in Wellesley with the Figs where my brother lived. And he's like, dude, I make a lot of money selling pizza. You do your food in Wellesley, you will crush it. Because there wasn't any good restaurants, period. Todd was the best restaurant. It was a pizzeria. So because of Todd saying, my brother who lived in Wellesley, they found the Wellesley Market, right, which was already for rent for like 8 months, and it was a perfect large space with walk-in coolers and
okay, now. so talk a little bit about the business, because you had gone to Cornell. You're really, you know, you knew the whole chef thing down. You opened a hotel, right? You knew it. So did you capitalize well? Was your business plan good right from the start?
It was because of the Cornell training, but more importantly because I opened four different restaurants in the hotel. So I did four restaurant openings. And when you do restaurant openings, the cream rises to the top. So you see what it takes to open a restaurant, and you see where to spend the money. You see where at that time where the Intercontinental lost so much money because they had change order, change order, change order, change order. So I swore to myself, when I open my restaurant, no change orders, do design build, which is I learned at Cornell, because if you know, just a curved banquette, five times more expensive than a straight banquette. Well, being my first restaurant, we're going to go straight, right? Linoleum ground in the bathroom versus tile saves me five times. We're going linoleum, right? So I built my restaurant, 120-seat restaurant. The budget was $500,000. I raised half of it through an SBA loan and half of it through $25,000 investors, which some of my family and my brother and great friends from college and whatnot, I said, look, you have to know that you could lose 100% of this and you're not getting it back. So if you can't afford to lose 25 G's, do not give it to me. And by the way, you get no votes, you get nothing, you are a silent partner, but please invest.
Can I ask what they made on their 25?
Oh, they made 300%. Yeah, they're fine. Everyone did really well. I was lucky, but you know, I mean, we were profitable the first month. It was because there was no, not East-West restaurant, was it? There's just no good restaurant.
You think young chefs, if they're smart, can do that today?
Yes, as long as you, everyone wants to open their dream restaurant, but that probably won't be your first one because you can't spend that much money. And this is one thing I did. I opened with enough cash flow that I could cover payroll for 2 months with zero covers. Because what happens is, and this is why restaurants close in the first year, is they're late opening, so they've already budgeted, well, we're going to do 200 covers every night, blah, blah, blah. But they're now 5 months late, 6 months late, so they didn't get that. So they already burned through all their cash. Then they're in a hole. So then they said, okay, so now you have extra pressure. Now we have to do 240 covers tonight. And then they do 180. So then, okay, well, let's buy choice beef instead of prime beef. And then it's that downward spiral, and you never get out of it. So start small. Start with cash because I was so lucky, and I know that, but most restaurants aren't going to be busy out the door. And by the way, I wasn't on TV then. No one, my chef friends knew me, but that was it. No one in Wellesley knew me. They just knew I was a restaurant. The one thing that I will say, and knock on wood, I still am on TV, being popular, you get every customer once because they're driving through Wellesley. Oh, they saw me on TV, then now they come. But you still have to offer an amazing experience at a great value. You get them the first time. If you don't do it well, they're gone too. And now with social media, you're really gone.
How hard was it to open a Chinese restaurant where people didn't think it was?
Well, it wasn't Chinese, right? It was East-West.
It was, yes. Yeah. But East-West was a new concept.
It was a new concept.
And so, you know, was that difficult, did it catch on?
It caught on quickly because we just used great product, solid technique, and it was a great value.
But you were one of the first ever to do that.
Yeah,
right.
but it was still.
You had to re-educate the diners.
It was, but it was still, there was still a steak and potato dish. It was just done my way, right? It just wasn't mashed potatoes, a piece of meat, right? It was done with, you know, what, fermented black bean this and bok choy that, but it was still steak with a starch. So
what was the best review that you got, and what was the worst review you got opening that year? Because a lot of our listeners are chefs, young chefs.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, no, I had two great reviews. The Boston Globe gave us 3 stars out the door. Allison Arnett. That was a fantastic review. And to get 3 stars there, we were so happy. And then I was anointed Chef of the Year by Esquire. By John Mariani. And it was good because Mario became friends because we were both on Food Network. We were both elected as best new restaurant for the James Beard Foundation because he opened Babu same year. And he won best new restaurant in the country. And I was happy to be included in that group of 8 or 10 restaurants. But then we were both also in the Esquire issue, but I got Chef of the Year. And the party for that was at Babu. So it's kind of all full circle. So we joke about it. But to quote Mario Batali.
Are you the same age?
Yeah, basically, I'm sure.
Basically, yeah. Joined at birth.
But he has the best thing about all these accolades and awards. I love Mario Stem. He goes, awards are awesome if you win them. Otherwise, I don't give a flying hoot about them, which is true, right? Because it doesn't make me a better chef that I won this or won that. It really doesn't. So those are the two best. Funny enough, the Wellesley College that first year, I got 2 bananas. That's how they rated their restaurants. 2 bananas. But we're talking about like a sophomore in college was grading me. Yeah, like the steak was raw, right? It was just medium rare. It was saignon. It was French saignon. The steak, he couldn't even cook a steak. It was a really mean review. But,
2 bananas.
2 bananas, I know. I mean, I don't even think Mario got 2 bananas.
So tell me, we're getting to the, actually, we've got the guests outside and, you know, we're going in overtime, but I just have to, some part of your career. I mean, you're just such an incredibly fine chef. And TV, I think, has a way of distorting that, that people sometimes see people on TV and they don't know what a high-quality chef. You hope that it comes through in the program.
Right.
You've been on TV for so long. You've watched the industry grow. Tell us your feeling about what are the pros and what are the cons, because you hear it all over.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the pros are what I said earlier. people will try your restaurant once because they see you. It says, okay, let's go try Blue Dragon, my new joint, 2 years old now, because they're in Boston, they know my name, they saw Simply Ming, and they come try. The challenge is, and the people will say this to my face, this better be the best meal I've ever had in my life. Because they just assume I'm in the black box, I'm the authority, and this better be awesome. So they have a chip on their shoulder, and you know, and I always joke, well, I hope you just ate at McDonald's. No offense to McDonald's, right? But I'm just, you know, I'm just trying to lower your bar.
Right.
And so there is. And nowadays, with the foodies, because I actually say, what the F is a foodie? And also, well, not everyone else in the world, but so do everyone else, most
yes.
people.
Yeah.
I mean, and you have the power of, you know, Twitter and this and that, and you can take me down, and I mean, right? And it's and people get really nasty. And they really think, they go, well, you don't comp this meal, I'm going to tell all of my 400 friends. You know what I mean? Like, people threaten you with that. It's like, look. We're doing the best we can. We think this is fine. You know, I mean, it's, so that is, I mean, you can talk to every chef. That's what really annoys us. And I do it quickly. I mean, I love taking pictures of food, but boom, boom, done. The people that literally take pictures of food and then start blogging it there. I'm like, dude, eat your food.
Right.
It's getting cold. It's okay to take a quick picture, but then enjoy your food. It's ruining people's dining experience. And I don't care that you know the nuance and this and that. Eat your food. Then write about it, right? Don't ruin your dress. You're spending a lot of money, $50, $60, $80, $100, whatever.
First of all, that's not dining.
No, it's not.
It's not having the experience.
Yeah, then these guys, I guess you can be a platinum, I guess, Yelper, and they get free T-shirts and this stuff and coupons. I'm like, I don't care.
So what's your message on your show? What do you want?
My show, Simply Ming is about getting people to cook simply. Right? Enjoy. I mean, I really think there's a huge issue in this country. The family fabric of this country is so deteriorated. So many families do not sit down at 6 or 7 o'clock and eat a meal together. That's a travesty. I used to sit down at 5:30, 5 o'clock with my grandparents, at 5:30 in Dayton, Ohio with my brother, mom, and dad. Everything went down at the dinner table, right? Always sat down. We always talked about grades, who were dating, who were not dating, about everything, vacation, this, what problems. Everything happened at the dinner table. Now it's ballet and soccer and this and that, and no one sits down, and people aren't eating well. People are buying everything to go and packaged and processed and this, and the whole art of cooking, the smell of the food in the home, that's the glue of, should be the glue of America. It's the glue of a family, though. If you do that as a family with your children, that will keep the family together. That will keep America, that will keep the world together. I always say, and this is why I love being a steak course chef, you know, which is what Hillary Clinton started, that when I go to a foreign country, there's a lot of us there, that they're using us as diplomacy. You know, I was honored to cook for now the president of China with Vice President Biden and Madam Secretary Clinton. And she actually pulled me aside later after that meal, and she said, that first, she loved the meal, and she said, this is really going to help our negotiations today. And sure enough, a week later, I get an email through the State Department that we are so happy how that went. We're going to start the steak course chef thing because we really think. And think about it. And if you're hangry or hungry, you're not going to make sound decisions. You're going to be a little more aggressive. And if you can – and by the way, we showed respect to that visiting president. So I cooked Chinese style, right? I wasn't going to put Japanese influence food there. So there we thought it through. So here's, we didn't do a salad first course, right? Because Chinese don't eat raw vegetables. We did a great sweet potato soup with a duck confit. Chinese love duck. So we really thought it through what he would enjoy. But it wasn't just Chinese food. So he appreciated that thought was put in. It wasn't just chicken. It was thought put into the meal to represent his own likings and tasting, but something different. And that helped.
What did your parents think that you got to cook at that level?
Oh, my dad came to it. My mom did not. My dad is so proud, just so proud. And probably, he was probably thinking, thank God you didn't go to be an engineer.
Okay, well, I think on that note, we've got to end this. We've got a lot of hungry people out there. Thank you. This was so wonderful.
Real pleasure. Real pleasure. And as always, peace and good eating.
Peace and good evening, and thank you, and thanks to our producers, Jack Innes, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.